You know, I just want to say to anybody who has experienced this, who is suffering in silence, who thinks that it only happened to them, you're not alone. And abuse does not have to be a life sentence.
Hello there. Welcome back to the My Future Business Show. It's Rick Nusky. As always, it is great to be with you. I love being this host. As you know, I get all of the opportunities to speak with some amazing people from around the world. And on today's show, I have the pleasure of welcoming retired U.S. Navy Commander and Marine, Mr. John Clubb. Welcome to the show, John.
Thank you, sir. Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here. And thank you for allowing me to take your time to do this.
Absolutely. Now, today, you and I, we're going to be talking about your work as author of the memoir Boys Cry 2. We're going to be talking about childhood sexual abuse, survivors' rights, and the push to make it a federal crime with no statute of limitations. So I'm certainly personally going to learn a lot from this call. So let's start at the start. Where are you calling in from today, John?
My wife and I live in Boca Raton, Florida. And she's sitting in the room with me, listening in. Jacqueline, say hi to Jacqueline. And she was very instrumental in helping me write this and give her input. And she has been one of my most staunch supporters over the years of this journey. So
fantastic.
Very glad that she's here too with us.
Well, hello there. You can show your face if you like to, but glad to have you with us. Hello there. Welcome to the show. Good to see you.
Hi. How are you?
I'm fantastic. I've got 2 feet and a heartbeat, like I always say. Can't complain. So, yeah, look.
It sounds like you two have the same accent.
No, maybe not. All right. Well, let's jump straight into the call. So you said you're in Florida. Is that home or do you travel there?
It's home for now. I grew up in Kentucky. And
Louisville.
I was born into poverty to a Kentucky school teacher and a Southern Baptist preacher. And do you want me to tell the whole story?
Yes, absolutely. This is for sure.
All right, so born into poverty, my father was a pedophile, serial rapist, wife beater, children beater. And I know, you know, I try to soften it sometimes, but I really can't. I could say he molested me, he sexually assaulted me, but he started raping me when I was 6 years old. And he was also abusing my brother. And he would get my brother involved in his sick activities. And it was a three-year process, but because of the violence of these attacks, my brain protected me from it, and so I did not start having memories of these events until I was 29. He was beating my mother, beating my brother, and it was a house that was filled with hate and bitterness and anger, and I learned at a very early age to be afraid. Mm-hmm. And I took that fear with me through a large chunk of my life. He was a malignant narcissist, and my mother, in her impotence and her victimhood, she projected her shame and her rage on me. So not only did I experience the sexual abuse from both him and my brother, but I also received the physical abuse from him, and also because of her. And then they, you know, I'm not going to go into the graphic detail because nobody needs to hear that. But they did some horrendously cruel things when I was growing up that would have ended up causing them to be jailed for life if they had still been alive and been prosecuted for it. So in this environment, she married my father because she thought that she was safe. She was sexually abused herself, and she thought that she was going to be safe marrying someone of the cloth and someone of God, and which she ended up marrying was a horror show. And so I have a brother and a sister, and my brother's since passed, but we all experienced this horrific childhood. And I went through, I went through school as a skinny, awkward teenager, and I withdrew into myself, and my escape was reading. So I read nonstop, 24/7, mm-hmm. until I could join the Marine Corps. I joined the Marine Corps when I was 17, and I wanted to be out of the house. So I went to the Marine Corps, and I was in the Marine Corps for 5 years, and I was a military policeman while I was there. And I wanted to be a Marine Corps officer and an aviator, but they didn't have any flying slots. So I talked to my Navy recruiter, and he promised me clean sheets and hot meals and all the flight time that I could stand. So I became I went to Aviation Officer Canada School after I earned my degree, because I had to have a degree to be an officer in the Navy.
Yeah.
And went to AOCS, went through that. I got my commission as a Navy officer in 1983. Went to flight school in Pensacola, and then I was an E-2C Hawkeye naval flight officer while I was on active duty in the Navy. And I was there. My initial duty station with this was in San Diego, which was a wonderful time, and just had a wonderful time. And then one of the things that the dynamic of my life, Rick, was that I was being abused by my father, mm-hmm. In a physical and sexual way, but my mother was so critical. And she was attacking me all the time, verbally. And what she ultimately made me afraid of was of a woman's rejection. And I was terrified of a woman's rejection. I took that into my adult life and into many of my decisions with the people that I was. But we got 30 days of leave in the Navy, and I spent my entire life. It was my mission in life was to get this woman to say, "I like you. I'm proud of you. You're okay." And she never did that. She died at the age of 57 with breast cancer. And she said one tender thing to me my entire life, and it was I went from San Diego, where I was flying with a squadron, to be a Navy ROTC instructor at the University of Minnesota, because then I could be within driving distance of where she was when she was going through cancer treatment, in hopes that I could finally be the good son. Mm-hmm. And so one day, one of the many times that I drove to Kentucky, the 12 hours from Minnesota to Louisville to be with her when she was going through her treatments, I was just so emotionally exhausted. And so just, I laid my head on her hospital bed and I sobbed. And I had never cried in front of my mother up until that point, because she had taught me at a very young age not to show any emotion, not to say anything, not to upset the apple cart in any way possible, or shape, fashion, or form. And the first time that she was ever tender with me was she laid her hand on my head and she just gently stroked it. And as I was walking out of the hospital room, she said, "John, you've always been my angel." And that was the first time in my entire life that she had ever uttered anything tender towards me. And I didn't know what to do. So I kept on walking, and walked out of her, hospital room, and she died shortly after and never shed a tear. It was in what I and out of that story is a very damaged, very hurt young man who learned at a very early age, you don't show any emotion. I remember, you know, my brother was a malignant narcissist also, and I'll be happy to share my thoughts on that if you're interested in that. Whenever I showed any kind of excitement, whenever I showed any kind of, you know, I had a new idea or I wanted to try something new, something, you know, anything that a kid might express to his family, these people were so intent on making sure that I didn't do anything better than them. They not only squashed that, but they wanted to bury it so that it could never emerge again. And so I learned at a very early age, you just don't show any emotion. And I joke, you know, these days, this is my joking voice. This is my angry voice. This is my happy voice. This is my sad voice. And I learned at a very early age, you don't show any emotion in my house. And so I learned how to be invisible. And that did me well when I was in boot camp and I was in AOCS when I had to be the invisible guy. So the drill instructors didn't hammer on me, but it hasn't worked out so well in my adult life. And I hope that makes sense.
Yes, it does.
You know, to some, you know, to the people who are listening. And I just want to say to anybody who has experienced this, who is suffering in silence, who thinks that it only happened to them, you're not alone. And abuse does not have to be a life sentence. I'll say that again. Abuse does not have to be a life sentence. These experiences shaped me, but they don't define who I am today. And it's over a period of time, a lot of work. And unfortunately, these people put dynamics on you that were unfair, and that you had never earned and never had, were supposed to deal with. But you are worth the journey, and you are worth the work, and you are worth the walk out of the darkness into the light. When I talked about these experiences, I talk about the differences between guilt, shame, and toxic shame. And it took me decades to learn what these words meant and what they create and what I needed to do to finally shed this. I call, you know, the toxic shame that I carried around for my life, the 800-pound demon that constantly chased me. Guilt says I did something wrong, I knew better, and I should have done it differently. Shame says I am wrong, everything about me is wrong. Toxic shame says, you know what, you don't even belong here. And a lot of us who have experienced these things in our lives carry that toxic shame. I personally carried a self-destructive streak that I constantly tried to, I joke about it, but I have snatched victory from our, I'm sorry, I've snatched defeat from the jaws of victory more times than once. And what it also produced in my life was just intense rage and anger. And I never knew where this anger was coming from. I never knew where this rage was coming from, because like I said before, I didn't even start to have memories of these experiences until I was 29. And it took me from age 29 to 40 before all of the memories started to gel and started to come out in a complete form. So every interaction, take, you know, it's complicated, but it's not, but I had this woman who constantly berated me, mm-hmm. who I was terrified of her disapproval. I had a father who was abusing me, a brother who was abusing me. And so I had this bottomless pit of rage and anger that I had to deal with. And, you know, to be honest, it's a miracle that I'm sitting here speaking with you tonight, Rick.
Absolutely.
Because by all means, I should have died of a drug overdose a long time ago, or I should have been incarcerated for life. And it's really a miracle of God that I'm sitting here speaking to you. And I'm so grateful for the opportunity.
Just this introduction to our conversation has just made me sit, you know, with my mouth wide open, just thinking, my goodness, I wonder now if we can, after having to rebuild yourself, what was, I guess, that catalytic moment? From what I recall, you were on a flight to go somewhere, and then it all sort of just unfolded for you. So there's that part of the question. But what does life as a result look like today? Is there love, joy, happiness in your life?
Well, and that's a great question. It has been a process where I have had to do a lot of therapy, a lot of talk therapy. And what really, I started having body memories in 1985, and I still occasionally have them where I will wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning feeling like I'm being raped. And it was on that flight that really was like, okay, it's time to stop this stuff. I had dabbled in talk therapy up until that time, but it was really, okay, what do I need to do to be able to live a full and meaningful life from that? And so the talk therapy got more intense. I started doing talk therapy at least once a week, if not twice a week. I started exploring different avenues. I did breath work, where you go into this like trance-like state. I worked with a therapist who did some, where I would do some strong imaging of all of this. But what really helped me was a process called EMDR. It's eye movement desensitization. Mm-hmm. I can never say that.
Me neither.
I can never say that word. Realignment.
Yes.
And EMDR. And I'm going to sound, I apologize, because I'm probably going to get this wrong.
Not at all.
If you split your brain in half, you have a left hemisphere and a right hemisphere.
Mm-hmm.
If trauma is stored in one of the hemispheres, and the other hemisphere is working overtime to try to heal that trauma. And what EMDR does, a trauma creates a wall in between your hemispheres. And what EMDR does is it eliminates that wall so that your brain can function as a wholly in itself. And what I've also kind of come to realize is when I have trauma, I have PTSD. I had it all. I had PTSD. I had, you know, night terrors. I had body memories.
The full bag.
You're looking through the telescope, and that trauma is sitting right at the end of the telescope all the time.
Mm.
And what EMDR does is it flips the telescope around so that it moves that trauma off into the distance so far that it no longer has any power over it. It doesn't make you forget about it. It doesn't make it disappear, but mm-hmm. it just doesn't matter anymore. And it's very simple. There's a light bulb that goes back and forth. You wear earphones.
Mm-hmm.
It is 20 minutes of some very intense feelings. But at the end of that 20 minutes, that trauma has been, I guess the only word that I can use is it's been healed.
It's healed.
And that really saved my life. And it made it then also, also understanding. Finally, you know, in therapy, I was in talk therapy for 30 plus years.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point, a therapist might have talked about toxic shame, might have talked about shame, but I wasn't in the spot.
Yeah,
I wasn't in the place to hear that. But until I heard those two words, I heard the side effects of that, and I was ready to deal with that, is when it came together and finally said, oh, okay, I can deal with this now.
Yeah.
That's something else that I want to share with anybody that might be listening to this, who have had this experience, is toxic shame does not belong to you. Your shame doesn't belong to you. It belongs to the people who put it on you because of their shame. And because of their shame, and you owe it to yourself to finally shed yourself of that. And the courage that got you through those experiences will get you through to the other side. And I applaud the six-year-old that I was, who endured this incredible brutality and these experiences from these two people that had no business being his parents.
It's a very deep topic.
What a courageous little boy.
Absolutely. And I have two young sons of my own, and I just cannot fathom what you're talking about. I'm hearing it. I understand it. Logically, I understand it, but you can understand from my perspective as a father of two young boys how I can't believe it, you know, and that's how horrific as must have been for you, John. And I admire your courage for coming on the show and sharing this way, because there are other people out there, other young people who need your help, who need to know that they're not alone. And we've touched on that. May I ask you, John, another question?
I think
about, you talked about talk therapy and 30 years of that plus, and it's still ongoing as far as I'm concerned for you. What about the power of the pen? I know that you talked about how you wrote the book, but it had to be rewritten, all the rest of it. Is there power in the pen? Did it help you to heal at all?
It did. And, you know, sometimes, you know, when I was writing the original War and Peace version of
Voice yeah,
I can laugh about it, Rick, because it's like I look at this thing and it's like, holy cow. It's like
intense, you know, is an understatement.
Like I'd get up in the middle of the night and I literally wore out a keyboard on a laptop.
A bit.
Because I was writing so much. But what, you know, once it started to come, it would not allow me to stop. And since it was a very, very good thing, and I would encourage people to sit and just write and handwrite it. Don't type it, handwrite it.
Yeah.
And the power from the brain to the fingers to the pen is very powerful in that, you know, if you decide that it's something that you can do.
You know, I think you did something smart, though. You had somebody rewrite it for you, and I think that's a credit to you, because it will be perceived a lot differently than it may have if you didn't. But tell me, how does the book, the memoir, challenge the idea that male vulnerability is a weakness, do you think?
Well, you know, that's a great question, too, because I wanted – and let's come back to
– Yep, for sure.
You talked about your sons – and how you couldn't imagine that happening to them.
Mm.
Hang on to that, and I want to talk about that after I address
the question here.
You know, society says that suck it up and deal with it. And in my own experiences, you know, I being a Marine, a U.S. Marine, and then being a naval aviator, and then being a commercial airline pilot, there's absolutely no room for a man to say, I'm hurting and I need some help. And the way that people look on those professions, I chose professions that were mostly male dominated because I felt more comfortable, and it was there were rules, and there were boundaries,
discipline
that were very disciplined, and all of that, which because of the chaos of my upbringing felt very comfortable. Mm. And I took on that mantle way too much. I took on the mantle of a Marine, and there's no way that anybody was going to get through the wall of Marine to hurt me anymore. And then I took on the mantle of naval aviator because nobody's going to get through the macho Top Gun. And I was an extra in the original Top Gun. Oh, wow. So it was like, you know, that was the world that I wanted to be in. I felt most comfortable in, but it was also a world that refused to let me feel. Mm. And that's really what I needed to be doing. And I was really good at snowing my therapist over the years and telling them what they wanted to hear and what I thought that they wanted to hear, and being, you know, rah rah, yeah, everything's cool.
The tough guy.
And then I was trying to drown my shame with alcohol, in a lot of different ways. So, and I see this, you know, in groups that I've been in, and I'm in a group every morning at 7. And as adults, older adults, we talk about things. When a man says that I'm hurting, I need help, the usual response is crickets or uncomfortable silence. And when a woman, and I'm not saying, you know, it's that women are bad. It's not bad. But when a woman does the same thing, other women elbow each other out of the way to get to the head of the line to try to support that woman. And it's a societal thing. We're expected to go out. We're expected to make a living. We're expected to come home and do what we do. And that's what being a man is, hunter-gatherer, and we don't have any problems, we don't have any hurts, we don't have any issues, and suck it up, buttercup, because that's what we are.
Yeah, that's the at least the traditional point of view of it, isn't it? Now, you mentioned that keep in my mind about my own children. Tell me a little bit more about your thoughts on being that family man now.
Yeah, if I could geek out on you just a little bit.
Absolutely.
Okay. So 1 in 3 women are sexually assaulted by the age of 18. One, and it's the numbers are, you know, between 1 in 7 and 1 in 9 men are sexually assaulted by the age of 18. Pedophiles usually have an average of 111 victims. And I see it in my own father's behavior. He was a Southern Baptist who was preacher, who was shuffled from church to church because of his behavior. Then he was a high school teacher.
Wow.
Then he was a high school counselor, which put him in contact with lots of children. These people put themselves in your children's way. And that's, you know, I don't look for pedophiles under every rock, but it really is the pedophile is the person that your children know. It's not the stranger with the, you know, the white van and the piece of candy and the puppy to pet.
Mm.
It's the person that your children know, that your children trust. And it is. So I've done the numbers, and the numbers are rough, but we've got 70 million people out there, Rick, that are suffering in silence, who think that this only happened to them. And they are getting up every morning, they're going to work, they're taking care of their families, and they don't realize that they are not alone. And that's really the message that I want to get out there. And also the fact that it took me 20 years to even start remembering this means that the statute of limitations in America just don't work. There's a few states that have lifelong statute of limitations for the rape of a child, but many of the states out there do not have room for somebody who doesn't remember for 20 years what happened to them.
Yeah.
And then they're lost and they don't know what to do or where to go. And for men also, I want to get back to your question about men and deal with this. When I wrote that book and I published it the first time, the lashback was horrific. I was flying for a major airline, and the assistant chief pilot in my domicile that I was flying out of decided that I was not worthy of ever flying an airplane again, and tried to railroad me out of not only the airline that I was working at, but she was going to make sure that I never touched the controls of an airplane again by losing my medical. She had it all planned out and she was trying to railroad me. And fortunately, somebody above her stepped in and said, "Hey, wait a minute, time
back
out.
Off.
Yeah. Let's back off." I have an ex-wife who I have three children with that I haven't heard from in over a decade, who used this book to try to wrest complete control and custody of our children because using this book, and her lawyers did that. That's a difference. You know, you want to talk about family court.
Wow.
And that's a completely different subject. But men face an incredible pushback when we say this happened to us. And you know, some of the common myths are the vampire effect. Somebody did this to me, so I'm going to do it to somebody else. That could not be further from the truth. But I've experienced that with the people that I have shared this with, that I shouldn't have shared it with, saying, "Hey, then I won't let you around my children." That statement came.
That's like saying that the reflection of your father is a reflection of you. That's just totally unfair and unreasonable.
Correct. Yeah, I agree with that. And then gay men face a lot of prejudice. You know, pedophiles must be gay. Let me make this completely and totally clear. Rape is not about sexual preference. It's about power. And it's about anger, and it's about control. And my father was a perfect example of that because he raped boys and girls equally. And a lot of these pedophiles do the same thing. And then I get the, "Well, why didn't you do something about it?" Well, I was 6 years old. So
yeah, what are you going to do at 6 years old?
Exactly. And my mother, my grandmother went to him and said, "Knock it off, or we're going to the police." And he looked at him and said, "Well, I'm going to kill him and his mother." And at that point, there was nobody coming. And this was the 60s also, Rick, where, you know, there weren't any of the protections that are in place, any of the minor protections that are in place today to protect children. And what I also wanted to say is, if you have had these experiences and you hear this and you realize that you are alone, please be careful about who you admit this to, because as victims, survivors, we don't know who to trust, because the people who we were supposed to trust the most betrayed that trust at the very early age. And if you say, you know, choose very carefully who you're going to tell this to. But once you say it out loud to somebody else, You move from victim to survivor, and I applaud you for that.
Absolutely.
It doesn't mean that it's going to be any easier, but you have made a giant, giant step towards healing.
Well, when we talk about healing, I'd love for people, as we're at the pointy end of the call already, this time has just flown by, John. I'd love for you to just share with us, if people want to buy this book or if they want to contact you to have a discussion. There it is. I love that cover.
There it is.
Yeah, is that you? Is that you in the center there?
It is.
I thought it might be.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, and, fantastic.
It's available on Kindle and Amazon and Barnes & Noble. And we have, my wife and I have a podcast that we do every week, and it's called The Marine and the Flower Child. Guess who the Marine is and guess who the Flower Child is.
I wonder.
Yeah, the one with the English accent. So we have a website that is being developed right now,
mm-hmm.
and I will be happy to, once that website, the website's going to also be The Marine and the Flower Child. But if you want to come and see how we interact with each other, we put up a podcast every week, and we have a really good time with that. And if you want to put comments in, we try to answer all of our comments. And if you want to talk about this further, I'm happy to talk about this with anybody. I'll give you my email on that if you make a comment or however. But I just, you know, the with the Epstein victims, and this is really kind of in the forefront, and my heart goes out to all of those people who had to endure that, and I want to say you're not alone.
Absolutely,
you're just not alone. And there is light at the end, and it's not fair. You have to fight for yourself, but please do not leave, because if we lose one of you, then all of us lose.
Look, that is a profound message. This is something that's pretty much rocked my world today, John, I have to tell you. And when that website certainly becomes available, make sure that you forward that link to me, please, John, so I can put it on the website. And for anybody else who is listening today, we've literally just scratched the surface of this. If you think about the timeline behind John's experience alone, we're talking decades of healing. So this is just the first step for you. If you're experiencing anything like this and you need help, you know what to do. You should reach out if you can. Beware of who you tell. And if you'd like to get your hand on this memoir of John's, I'll be making sure that the link is available to you below this post. No matter where you see this call, you're going to find the links back to John and his memoir. And with that being said, John, great call. Thank you so very much for sharing your story on the show today.
Well, thank you, sir. I really appreciated this, and I've really enjoyed our time together. And I commend you for bringing this to the forefront. So thank you so much.